What should we be eating 50 years or even 5 years from now? Celebrated chef Dan Barber of Blue Hill and Stone Barns fame is here to talk about his new book, The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food.
The answer has got to be we have to dig a bit deeper and cook with these crops that end up restoring health and vitality to the system, to the farming system.
How deep into the ocean are human beings meant to go, and what will they find there? James Nestor joins us to talk about his new book, Deep: Freediving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves.
This isn't just something like I checked out for a little while to write about. It's now a part of my life.
My colleague John Williams and I will chat about what's going on this week in the book business, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Dan Barber is here. He is the author of The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Hi, Dan.
Hello, Pamela.
Dan is also known as the owner and chef. Is that the proper title for you?
That's me.
Blue Hill, which for those who don't eat there or visit, is probably well known as the restaurant where the Obamas went, sort of their first night out in New York City after coming to the White House. Isn't that right?
Yes.
All right. Had to just get that in there. But you've written not a cookbook, but really an interesting exploration of the food today and the future of food and sort of how we got there and what we'll be eating in the future. How did you come to the idea of writing this book?
Well, I didn't set out to write the book you just described, but thank you for encapsulating it like that. I set out to explore these like ingredients that I was utilizing on my menu, cooking with every day, and realizing that there was something special about the ingredient. I wanted to, in some ways, write a cookbook that explored how this particular ingredient was grown.
This is wheat?
Well, wheat sort of kick-started this thing because I wanted to cook with a local, I wanted to bake with local wheat and use flour in breads and other things that came from a local farmer. And I found this farmer named Klaus Martens, who I guess ends up being kind of the hero of the book. I really had no particular interest in wheat, except I tasted this variety called Emmer coming from off of his farm was just like this jaw-droppingly delicious flavor that ended up igniting a real passionate response from our diners and all this stuff. So I realized I had never made bread better than with his wheat. And then I went to visit his farm to write about him for the book. And I was standing in the middle of 2,200 acres, which is his farm, which is a rather large farm, although by grain standards, not that large. Mm-hmm. But I was standing in the middle of it and I didn't see much wheat at all. What I saw were crops like buckwheat and barley and rye. Those are all soil building crops, crops that add a lot of fertility to the soil. I saw cover crops, which are big soil fertility crops like vetch and clover. And I saw leguminous crops like beans, Austrian winter peas, and kidney beans. So I saw this whole suite of diversity, I guess, around me. And what I learned was that Klaus was planting these crops, these lowly sort of uncoveted grains and leguminous crops and taking up space with these cover crops to add fertility back to the soil. And he was doing it in these very meticulously timed rotations to give the soil the right fertility it needed to grow wheat that actually tasted stunningly delicious. I own a family farm, so it's not like I didn't, and I have a farm to table, I have a restaurant in the middle of a farm. So I'm like, I've really both got a skin in the game and thought I knew my thing and knew the stuff. And what I didn't really realize is while I understood this idea that we need to, when we eat something, when we harvest something, especially something truly delicious, like a great crop of wheat, it requires a ton of soil fertility. It is expensive biologically. It withdraws. Klaus, this farmer, uses the analogy to a bank account. Soil is a bank account. Every time you harvest something, we eat something, we withdraw from the bank. And with wheat, we make a huge withdrawal. So we need to return. We need to make a deposit. So these crops are there to make soil fertility deposits into the bank. And what I realized very quickly and sort of alarmingly is that as a farm-to-table chef, as a champion of this great agriculture, I was supporting almost none of it. I mean, I was taking the cream of the crop, essentially, this wheat cream, in the sense that it's very expensive fertility from a fertility perspective. And I wasn't supporting any of the crops that Klaus was growing, and by the way, not making any money on, which is the key point in this whole thing,
right?
Because those were sunk costs for him. They were either plowed under to actually provide direct soil fertility for microorganisms in the soil, or they were sold as bag feed. So we were eating the grains, I guess, in the sense that we were eating meat, because those bag feed gets fed to dairy cows, or we drink milk, or to chickens, and we eat eggs, or to beef cattle, and so we eat beef, but we have a steak. So we get that fertility. It's an incredibly inefficient way to have it. And it's not a good economic return for the farmer. So what I realized is, like, I need to do a lot more work in my cooking and my menu and celebrate these uncoveted and overlooked grains and cook with the whole farm, which is sort of like
holistic kind of farming.
It's very holistic. Yeah. His farming was holistic. The question for me and for us, for eaters, is how do you support that?
Right.
And if farm to table is the answer, I think it's going to come up a little bit short, because we are cherry picking what we want in farm to table, where we treat a farmer's market or our support of this local food movement by cherry picking the ingredients we most want to eat. And that's delicious, and it's right, because it's a direct and connected,
right.
It's good. It's better than an industrial food system, for sure. But the answer has got to be, we have to dig a bit deeper and cook with these crops that end up restoring health and vitality to the system, to the farming system, and then celebrate these crops like wheat. I could say the same thing about tomatoes.
Right.
We're about to head into a big tomato season. They're the same thing. Big fertility sucker. They're the Hummers of the vegetable and fruit world, whereas we celebrate them as these incredibly delicious and nutritious opportunities in our diet. They also are expensive.
Presumably, you're saying that it's also environmentally destructive, that we tend to think of sort of eating from, buying food from a local farm as being the environmentally correct thing to do, but that the way that we're eating from these farms and the way these farms are producing things are also not great for the environment.
I'd be hesitant to say destructive. What I would say is it's not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it's destructive, in the sense that, like, if we are just requiring the farmer to sell only the crops that we covet, we're very quickly cornering ourselves into an expensive proposition. Those costs, those sunk costs of all those other crops that I was looking at in his wheat field, for example, in Klaus's wheat field, he's paying for them.
Right.
And we're paying for them through the wheat. So it's part of the reason that the farm to table movement gets such an elitist reputation, is because we are paying for the cream, when in fact, if we paid for the diversity that supports the farm, the costs would go down.
Right. Now, I don't know if this is the focus of your book. I think not. But I have to bring it up because we started with wheat, that wheat is kind of seen as the villain of the moment. And I'm curious if this has to do with one of the things that people say, and I don't know if it's based on knowledge or not, is that, well, the way in which wheat is currently eaten is sort of very far off from what wheat is meant to be, and therefore is making people sick or...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you just look at the amount of wheat that's planted, 60 million acres. And when you look at grain in this country, wheat is a big one, obviously, but we eat mostly wheat. We're a wheat culture. Western civilization is built on wheat. And as much as, you know, every other person is gluten intolerant today, it seems, we still eat more wheat than we eat meat. And we eat more wheat than we eat vegetables and fruits and fish combined, almost. So we eat a tremendous amount of wheat. And if the wheat's not right...
When it's not wheat, it's corn. And when it's not corn, it's soybean
oil. Well, even
oil.
Corn. I mean, we grow more corn per on acreage, for sure. But we don't. 40% of that goes into our fuel tanks. So and then in processed food. So really the direct eating is going on is with wheat. And I don't think it's gotten the attention that it deserves, because if it's not right, our diets aren't right. And we're realizing that very quickly. And the potential for fixing wheat, in other words, for getting the right kind of wheat with the right nutrition, it's actually kind of low-hanging fruit. It's right there. Whole wheat is whole nutrition. We've managed in the past 50 years not just grow it in the wrong way, it seems to me, but also to break the wheat seed up into disparate parts. And we don't truly eat whole wheat. If we were treating wheat as we treat, let's say, coffee that I had this morning, which is, you know, going to Starbucks, which I did, and they grind the beans right there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have your espresso. That's where you get the full flavor of the coffee. Well, it's the same thing with wheat, but it's not just the flavor, because it's also the nutrition. And when you break apart the wheat kernel and you just eat the white stuff, as we mostly just do, you are getting almost zero nutrition. And the potential for whole nutrition is in the whole wheat. If we really want to think about the future of agriculture, Like grains are about 60% of our farmland. Vegetables are about 5%.
What should it be?
Well, it's a good question. I don't know that the proportions are off in the sense that like we should be 60% vegetables and 5% grains. I don't know how efficient that would be because grains are really supportive to soil. If they're grown in the right way, you can end up having great fertility, great strength, which is, by the way, where the foundation of our health comes from, which is also what I learned. So it's not so much that we should reverse that and grow more vegetables, although we should. We should probably grow less corn, I guess. But the point is we really, I think, need to look at how we grow our grains and grow them in a different way. And also, I shoulder a lot of the blame or the responsibility on chefs because we are promoting a certain kind of diet. And we are, as weird as it is for me to call chefs cultural icons, because I would be calling myself a cultural icon, but we are in a spotlight. We are curating a certain kind
Absolutely.
Of not just taste, but also culture now. And we ought to be helping create a framework for a diet that is more delicious. And by definition, when it's more delicious, it is by definition more nutritious because they're one and the same thing. So this is the challenge, I think, for the future is not just farm to table, which is celebrating certain crops, but putting it all together.
Mm-hmm.
And like all great cuisines have done, all the great cuisines of the world have been about a negotiation between a peasant farmer and their landscape and eking out what the landscape can provide and then making it nutritious and delicious. I just came from an interview where the interviewer said, well, how do you take these ideas and put them into a cheesecake factory menu. Well, I was like, you know, I don't know that that's the challenge.
Right.
You know, the real challenge is like create 1,000 cheesecake factories that are micro expressions of our ecologies. America's, and that's the other lesson of the book. So how can we expect the United States to have one diet? It's in one cuisine, one answer to this. It's actually many hundreds, if not thousands, of patterns of eating that reflect the landscape.
Right. And presumably there are implications not only for how we grow and for the sort of on the industrial level, but also for restaurants and then the way we eat in our homes.
Yeah. I think that bleeds into. That's why I'd say the shouldering, the chefs, because it's a lot for a home cook to shoulder,
mm-hmm.
put it together.
Right.
The home cook has enough trouble getting these products, affording them, A, B, getting to a farmer's market or supporting a CSA or supporting a market that a supermarket that supports this kind of stuff. It's hard to find and it's expensive and it takes a lot of time and you have to cook. So there's a lot of variables
right.
there. So I'm looking at chefs and pointing the finger at me, especially because I think we can shoulder this thing. And by definition, you know, the things that excite chefs, this is a general rule, but it's pretty steadfast, is that we're excited by the things that take some challenge to cook. And we're talking about ingredients that are a little bit harder to cook.
Right.
Buckwheat is a little bit harder to cook. Cuts of meat, we talk about nose-to-tail eating of the animal. We should be talking about nose-to-tail eating of the farm. And that means cooking with ingredients that take a little bit more thought and
passion.
We
need the beef cheeks for the farm
world. We need the beef shank and the beef cheeks for the whole farm. And that takes some culinary application, which is why I think chefs are well situated
right.
to do something here.
So you call the book the third plate, the first plate being meat, largely meat-based, the second plate being vegetable and farm-based. What is the third plate?
The third plate is putting it together for where you live. And so I don't know what a third plate is in southeastern Texas, just as much as I don't know what a third plate is in North Dakota, parts of North Dakota. I know.
What is it for Blue Hill?
Well, this is a late inning revelation in the sense that like I really needed to change my cooking and create a pattern of eating, a cuisine around the cooking of the Hudson Valley. So I know it includes meat. I know it includes dairy because the Hudson Valley was built on dairy.
Yes.
It was built on pasturing because we've got rainfall and incredible grasslands. We've got very rocky terrain. So we're not a vegetable-centric place to grow food, although we can grow great vegetables here and even some fruits. But, you know, I'm sensitive to vegetarians because I eat a lot of vegetables too and grains. But to prescribe that as the diet of our region or to demand it is to demand a lot of resources mm-hmm. for our region that don't exist. If you're in Southern California, you want to be a vegetarian, God bless you. You should be.
What year did Blue Hill open?
It opened in 2000.
In 2000.
Blue Hill, New York. Yeah, and Blue Hill at Stone Barns, my other restaurant, opened in 2004.
What is different about what you're serving at Blue Hill now versus what you were doing in 2000? And sort of how does that reflect?
When I stood in the middle of that field with Klaus's farm and I realized it wasn't supporting him, I wanted to create a dish that supported the whole farm. So in Klaus's case. So what I did is we put on the menu, it's there, it'll be on the menu tonight if you're interested in coming in for dinner. It is called Rotation Risotto. So Rotation Risotto is these uncelebrated celebrated, uncoveted for a large part, in many ways unknown grains, leguminous crops, even some cover crops that we make into a puree and thicken this this
little
stew.
these unknown?
Well, it depends on the time of year. Tonight you'll see the buckwheat, the barley, the rye that we talked about. You'll see some brassicas. You'll see like a little bit of cabbage in the puree that helps thicken this. You'll see some seed crops. You're going to see all the crops that benefit soil fertility that gives us the wheat that we so covet. And I wanted a dish that celebrated that idea and got people asking when they look at the menu and say, what is rotation? Well, it's not rice because we don't grow rice here. What we need to do is get that cultural context of risotto, which everyone loves for good reason, and actually get more flavor out of it, which is what you can get with these grains. We sprout the grains, we malt the grains, we do a lot of work to get it. And we're using a dozen different grains. But it's super delicious. And
I was going to say, and how does it taste?
Yeah. No, it's super delicious. And I don't say it arrogantly. I say it just that it's the grains at work. It's really the fertility of the soil that's at work. As while we're adding all this color and application to it, I think it's important to add that it starts with the soil. Without it, you know, we wouldn't get those flavors.
All right. Well, people will be looking for that recipe for rotation risotto.
Yeah. Okay.
Dan Barber, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The book, again, is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food by Dan Barber, reviewed this week by Corby Kummer. John Williams joins me now with some news about what's going on in the book business this week. Hi, John.
Hi, Pamela. How are you?
Good. So there were lots of bestseller kind of stories this week, what with J.K. Rowling or Robert Galbraith's new book coming out and the international bestseller, The Truth About the Harry Kubert Affair, which is not turned into such a runaway success here.
Right,
but
not yet.
But we will talk about loftier things, perhaps. What happened this week in the world of poetry?
Yeah, away from the bestseller list. Although maybe, who knows, maybe his book will hit the list now that this news has happened. Oh, it has happened. That's great. Charles Wright was named America's Poet Laureate late last week. Our colleague Jenny Schuster wrote a really great profile of him for the paper when the news was broken. And Wright is 78 years old. He's a retired professor at the University of Virginia. And of course, more importantly, for the Library of Congress's purposes, they're the ones who named the Poet Laureate. He's the author of about 24 collections of poetry. And so this is a one-year gig. You can get it extended to 2 years sometimes, I think, at the Library of Congress's decision.
If the job isn't done.
If the job, they feel like you have a lot more to do. And he takes over for Natasha Trethewey, who's a much younger poet who held the job previously. And it's kind of an undefined role. I mean, but it's not just a figurehead role. You kind of have to figure out what it entails. You know, community outreach, a little bit of, you know, spreading the good word about poetry. And Wright said to Jenny on the phone, I thought this was funny. He said, I really don't know what I'm supposed to do, but as soon as I find out, I'll do it. And she said that he's, you know, a very sort of soft-spoken and self-effacing Southerner who tried to write fiction very early on in his career and found that he was one of the rare Southerners who couldn't tell a story. So he turned to poetry instead.
A failed novelist turns to poetry.
And obviously became a very successful poet. And he writes very sort of not, you know, topical or political poetry. It's very nature-based. It's very taken with questions of spirituality and religion, something that he's kind of moved away from later in his life but is still obsessed with as a subject and a theme. You know, as the Library of Congress's James Billington said about the decision, he said that Wright has a combination of literary elegance and genuine humility, which is the rare alchemy of a great poet.
Natasha Trethewey do during her year?
There are different things that people do. And one of the things she did, which is great, is that she actually held office hours at the Library of Congress. So I'm not sure. I think it was open to the public. And I don't know who took advantage of it or whether they went in looking for advice for their own writing or just to talk about things. But she took it seriously as a kind of as a real post. You know, I'm here and I'm in the office ready to go with my name tag.
Come to me with your poetry issues.
Yeah, I think that Wright is going to be probably not going to do that. He spends, you know, much of the year in Montana in a very small place there. And so I don't think he's going to be hanging out in D.C. a ton with the public. But he, like I said, the best is yet to come for him. He has to kind of figure out what the job's going to entail.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that post. Thanks so much, John.
We will. Thanks, Pamela.
Joining me now, James Nestor, author of Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves. Hi, James.
Hi there.
This book is about free diving, but also about the depths of the ocean. Did it start off with free diving, or did you start off wanting to write a book about the ocean?
It did start off with free diving. I was on assignment in 2011 to cover something called the World Free Diving Championship in Greece. And I didn't know too much about free diving, had never seen it, didn't know any of the competitors, and went out there, and it completely blew my mind. These guys were doing things that I didn't think was humanly possible, and that really sparked the book.
It is such an unusual, if minor, sport. Can you explain what we mean by free diving?
Well, there's recreational free diving, which is pretty sane, and then there's competitive free diving, which, in my opinion, is pretty insane. It's where a bunch of people get together and test to see who can go the deepest and come back up conscious. So if you come back up unconscious, you are saved by a bunch of safety divers and you are disqualified from that particular competition. But if you come back up conscious, then your dive depth counts. And those are all calibrated and posted to later on that evening, and the winners are announced. So it's a very strange event. I likened it to competitive yoga, where people bend as much as they possibly can without breaking. And sometimes in competitive freediving, people break by either passing out or, in one case, some guy came up technically dead and had to be resuscitated. So
wow.
Pretty gruesome scene.
And readers of the New York Times may remember there was an issue last year where we published a photo of Nicholas Malvoli moments after he completed a free dive and before he died.
That's I remember seeing that picture on the front page, and it brought back some pretty awful memories of competitive free diving. I didn't know Malvoli, but I knew everyone else there at the competition. And just as I had said at the beginning of the book when I first started researching this in 2012, it's just a matter of time before people start dying in this sport, and there you go. I mean, it's just tragic, and hopefully the sport will be banned.
What happens to the human body at those depths?
Various things happen to the human body, and depends really at which depth. We are imbued with something called the mammalian dive reflex, which kicks in at various levels depending on how deep you dive. So at around 30 feet, your lungs are about half the size as they would be at the surface. And your body starts compensating by flooding blood from the extremities into your core to keep your organs from bursting under the pressure. And this just increases over and over and over the deeper you go. By the time you're at 300 feet, the pressures are about 10 times out of the surface, and your lungs are the size of two fists. And your body is really working overtime and kicking in all of these amphibious reflexes that we all have, but so few of us ever really need to use because so few of us are ever willing to dive that deep.
You talk about in the book, you know, that people will come to the surface with blood pouring from their noses. The case of Nicholas Malvoli, he emerged with these bulging eyes. What exactly happens to the pressure of the body?
Yeah, again, that is competitive free diving, which is completely different than recreational free diving. But with competitive freediving, what happens is all of the blood is suddenly entering into the core, and then it has to exit out of the core the quicker that you get to the surface. So there is this huge transfusion of blood all over the body that's happening. But what's happening to Malvoli is you have to relax your larynx and relax your whole body. If you tighten up, then these muscles aren't going to be able to flex under the pressure, and they're going to rip. And that's what happened to him. I believe that's what happened to him. I haven't
heard
the medical reports. Actually, I don't really want to. But it's common. He had a bunch of fluid in his lungs because his musculature and the areas that were supposed to flex weren't flexing because he went down there and tried to push himself into deep water, which is always a dangerous thing. You just never do that. So,
in the course of writing the book, you yourself learned to free dive, not competitively, recreationally. What was that like?
It was more of a mental challenge than anything. I've spent most of my life in the water and in the ocean, so I'm very comfortable in there. But I was introduced to freediving through competitive freediving. So it took me months and months of trying to get those pictures out of my head of, you know, guys coming up unconscious and blood all over their faces. But luckily enough for me, I was introduced to some of the more philosophical, and you could even call them spiritual freedivers, who did this just for the joy of doing it. They never pushed their body deeper than they needed to go, and they did it for one specific reason, which was to commune with oceanic animals, because freediving is the only way you can get close enough to many animals to study them. And that's what I spent the majority of the time researching, these animals, these free divers, and that world.
Had you done scuba diving before you did free diving?
I've done a lot of scuba, yeah, but free diving is just such a completely different thing. One free diving instructor said, and I think he really put it well, he's like, scuba diving is like going bird watching with a leaf blower on your back, because everything leaves you. You are a menace in the underwater world. In free diving, you are completely silent, and you are completely free to swim around quickly with these other animals, and they welcome you into their pods and into their schools, and it's just, it's a real paradigm shift.
If you could sort of draw an example of a scuba diving experience and your encounters with the life undersea, and then with free diving, and what made the difference?
Sure. At the beginning of the book, I try to follow some more institutional research and go down in scuba to the only underwater habitat in the world, which is 60 feet deep off the coast of Key Largo. And people live down there for 10 days at a time, and they do all this amazing research on coral and sponges and fish and so on and so forth. But you can only get down there by scuba diving. So I spent some time down there and scuba around. And again, it's, you can see animals from afar, but they never really allow you to get close enough to really hang out with them, to learn their behaviors, and to study them. On the other hand, a year later, I was free diving in the same area off the coast of Florida, and I free dived down to around 30 feet, got down to the seafloor, laid down, and was completely surrounded by various schools of fish. They actually let you into their schools and let you hang out with them and really study them. And it's just a really different experience. It's the same thing with studying dolphins or studying whales. Scuba is very loud to their sense of hearing, and they just don't want you around if you're scuba diving. If you're free diving, you're welcome to join them. And that's what we spent many months doing.
You structured your book in an interesting way, going from ground or sea level down to 28,700 feet. How deep can you go free diving? Where's the cutoff there?
The world record free dive is 700 feet, and that was done on a machine. So this guy built a machine to take him down to 700 feet and take him back up again. He attempted 800 feet and didn't make it. And unfortunately, I was there. His name is Herbert Nitsch. He is fine. He's alive now. He's still suffering some problems. But again, it just speaks to the dangers of competitive freediving and how I don't think people should be doing that.
What happened to him?
He suffered about 6 strokes on the way up. He was paralyzed for about 3 months. He still has trouble using his right arms and right legs. He has trouble remembering things. He, you know, just basically suffered a series of debilitating strokes within the course of a few hours upon surfacing. So the whole thing was just absurd and disgusting. And after seeing that, I swore off ever looking at this sport, if you could call it that, again. Until, of course, I saw the front page of your newspaper a few months later. So.
You continue the narrative after 650, you go to 800 to 1,000 feet. How deep did you go, obviously not free diving, during the course of the research?
The deepest any private citizen can possibly go is aboard a handmade submarine in Roatan. And it's completely illegal. You know, in Roatan, there's a fine line between illegal and legal. They don't really care. It's run by a guy named Carl Stanley. So he made this submarine about 4 years ago, and he'll take people down to about 2,500 feet. And I boarded the sub, went down to Roatan, and took a ride with him. And that's about as deep as a private citizen can go. You know, if you're James Cameron, you can build a deep sea sub and go down 35,000 feet. But I don't quite have those means.
Well, what did you see at 2,500 feet?
What didn't I see? I saw where the majority of life on the planet lives, and it's in complete blackness, and it's a very spooky world. Lots of gelatinous, strange creatures down there. And things, it's interesting, every time this guy, Carl Stanley, goes down to this depth, which is often, he does about twice a day, and he's been doing it for about 7 years, he sees new stuff, unknown to science. So we don't know what 99% of the stuff is down there, because nobody goes down there. Nobody really spends the time to study these animals. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe they're just too gross, or there's no incentive for scientists to have an interest in deep sea life. But so we were just seeing new stuff that no one's ever seen. It was as close to space exploration as anything I can imagine. Very spooky, very weird, pretty scary, an amazing experience.
You continue, though, to 28,700 feet. What happens at that depth?
At those depths, that's known as the Hadal region, and that is the most inhospitable environment on Earth. I found one researcher working in San Diego that does Hadal research, and he has found at depths of 35,000 feet the world's largest amoebas, a single-celled animal the size of your fist that scoots around on the seafloor, that's able to feed and to mate, and yet this animal has no brain, has no nervous system, doesn't have any of those things, and yet it's totally conscious. So that's just sort of an example of the stuff you find down there. Nobody knows what's down there because nobody's looking. And that's the real tragedy, because I think we could learn a lot about our planet and ourselves by spending a little research money and heading down there.
You're done with the book. You've seen some scary things, obviously, in the course of your research. Do you want to go back? Do you miss being in the water at that depth?
Well, later on today, I'm driving up the coast to Sonoma and going freediving with a bunch of guys to go catch some abalone. So this isn't just something like I checked out for a little while to write about. It's now a part of my life. And I know that at the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about how grotesque and spooky it is on the competitive side, but I just want to reiterate that recreational freediving is the polar opposite of competitive freediving. It's very akin to yoga or meditation, and it's just part of what I do now, and it's one of the most incredible things that I've discovered. So work overlapped with my recreational lifestyle here, and it's been great.
All right, well, what else can we say to that but have a great dive?
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. That was James Nestor, author of Deep, Freediving, Renegade Science, and What the Ocean Tells Us About Ourselves, reviewed this week in the book review by David Epstein. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
There are three new titles on the hardcover fiction list. Down at number 15, the novelist Emma Straub has a new book called The Vacationers. It's her third book and her second novel and her first bestseller, 3-2-1. Her father, if the name Emma Straub sounds familiar at all, her father is the famous horror novelist Peter Straub. Like Stephen King's son, Owen, who's also a writer, she's gone in her own direction. Like Owen King, she does not write horror. And The Vacationers is a story of family breakup on vacation in Mallorca, Spain.
Horror of a certain kind.
Exactly. Domestic horror. Then at number five, Ellen Hildebrand, the best-selling perennial, who writes books set on Nantucket, has a new novel called The Matchmaker. The interesting thing about this novel is that one of the central characters in the novel is fighting breast cancer. And about a month before the book was published, Hildebrand herself learned that she had breast cancer. And she actually ended up undergoing a double mastectomy just 3 days after publication. So it turned out to be a book with more personal impact than she expected it to when she started writing it. And she wrote in an essay for Huffington Post that she used the character to give her some inspiration and strength. She said, "I told myself that if I could write a character like Dabney, then I could be like Dabney."
Wow.
Yeah.
Life imitating art.
There you go. And finally, the last new book on the hardcover fiction list this week is new at number one. It is the eighth book in Diana Gabaldon's Outlander series. This is a series of time travel romance adventure books that she's been writing over 20 years now on this series. The eighth book is called Written in My Own Heart's Blood. And it comes out just about a month and a half before Starz TV starts their TV show, their series based on the Outlander books.
All right, nonfiction?
There are three new titles also on the hardcover nonfiction list this week. Down at number 16, the Russia expert Helen Rappaport has a book called The Romanov Sisters that is about the four daughters of Nicholas II, the last Tsar of Russia. The young royals, Olga, Tatiana, Maria, and Anastasia, Nicholas's daughters, who were all executed in 1918. And so it's a story about kind of the last days of the royalty in Russia and the approach of the revolution there. Then at number 11, the father and son TV journalists Bill Geist and his son Willie Geist have a book called Good Talk, Dad. Bill Geist is a correspondent for CBS News, and Willie Geist, of course, is an anchor on the Today Show. Good Talk, Dad is your typical father-son conversation, the birds and the bees, all of these things, except between two grown men. The idea behind the book is that they never had these conversations growing up, but it's never too late, so they're turning to it now.
Hopefully they know some of that material at this point. All right.
And then the last new book on the hardcover nonfiction list this week is no real surprise. Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Who?
her memoir, Hard Choices, makes its debut at number one.
Okay. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.